This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
Glass seems to be this one material that keeps on improving. You know, the sophistication of the coatings, and in this case, the addition of Frit, which has been around for a while, all work together to improve the performance of the envelope.
We weren't just doing one model of one idea. We were comparing dozens and dozens of iterations of different glass combinations, different Frit patterns, different orientations of things on the building. So it was really, you know, a study to kind of find out what worked best throughout the project. I'd echo what Phil said here. You know, it's high performance buildings are what we're trying to do. And you know, this team really knew how to push that envelope.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, Senior Specification Writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guests today are Philip Castillo, FAIA, Managing Director at Yawn, with offices all over the world, and Benjamin Skelton, President of Cyclone Energy Group. Philip Castillo, FAIA, has over 40 years of experience leading complex and diverse architectural projects around the world. He oversees all aspects of design, planning, management, and systems integration, ensuring that the original intent is carried through every stage. His portfolio includes global landmarks such as Sony Center Berlin, Shanghai New International Expo Center, Tokyo Station Yaesu Development, and 1000M in Chicago, alongside innovative smaller-scale works like the Herald and Margot Schiff Residences. A fellow in the American Institute of Architects since 2010, Castillo combines technical rigor with design clarity. Benjamin Skelton is the founder of Cyclone Energy Group, a Chicago-based firm dedicated to optimizing building performance. Since starting the firm in 2012, his team has gained international recognition for bridging the gap between design, construction, and operations on landmark projects. Benjamin's award-winning portfolio involves driving decarbonization in existing buildings, enhancing the efficiency of everyday facilities, and helping design pioneering high-rises and net-positive projects. The project we're talking about today is the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in Summers, Wisconsin. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. The Pritzker Military Archive and Library in Summers, Wisconsin, is conceived as an architectural expression of order, transparency, and longevity. The 48,400 square foot facility expands the mission of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library through a built form that makes its purpose visible.
Well, the driver to make this a reality was that the Pritzker Military Museum and Library had a backlog of information being books, uniforms, medals, artwork by soldiers in the trenches, ammunition, firearms. And this was all being stored in an area in Chicago in an older warehouse that did not have the correct climate controls or any of the other necessities needed. So they felt a desire to build a ground-up facility for storing all this archival material. And that's how it started. And as the project developed and as we were working with them, you know, we added a kind of an ante room in the front where you come in, and that became an exhibition area. And then there was this plaza for ceremony. So as the project evolved and the program evolved, it became more than just an archival storage facility. And the building was, the complex was much bigger. It had this pavilion with these kind of concrete boxes on either side of them that were for storage and for future other commercial archival storage. But it ultimately got narrowed down to a 17.5-acre site. And that site has the building that you see today with the archival storage in the basement. I should also say that, you know, originally Colonel Pritzker bought a little over 200 acres that extended from the east end of our site all the way to Interstate 94. And the intention was to put a firearms education center, otherwise known as a gun range, and a sporting clays course, which I always akin to foursomes with rifles. And ultimately, through many meetings with the community, it got scaled back. They did build a firearms education center on the far west of the site and into our building on the far east of the site that will ultimately have a monument to the Cold War, which they're raising money for now. And it would also have a solar field, which will get expanded. And there's almost a backstory to the solar field. And that is, we originally had all these solar collectors on the roof of the storage buildings. And then when it became one building, we had it on top of the building. But what we learned was, because the museum was a not-for-profit and the building was actually a not-for-profit site, they could not sell excess energy back to the grid. So we put the solar farm separate, which is actually more efficient than having it on top of the building, so that it could be a separate entity that would then be able to sell excess energy back to the grid.
And you're able to have more solar generation too. When it was on top of the building, you were limited to the footprint. And this didn't come up on this, but a lot of warehouse projects were storing precious materials. They don't like to have solar panels on the roof. It could be a fire threat or a life safety threat to that building. So this was neat that it got moved off the building. Although it was pretty neat when it was one building and it was kind of incorporated into the glass system. That was really cool.
At its core, the building supports the long-term preservation of military history. Nearly 15,000 square feet of below-grade archival storage is paired with exhibition and research spaces that invite visitors to see how collections are cared for and studied.
The building is a 46,000 square foot facility with 26,000 square feet of exhibition space, research offices, processing, and back of house like book restoration and 3D imaging in 26,000 square feet. In the basement below is 15,000 square feet of archival storage and another 5,000 square feet of conventional mechanical space. This building then sits on a 17.5-acre site that was meticulously designed by Tom Osland at O2 Design, which is a landscape architect. And the references to all these things were all military-inspired.
Central to the design was uniting ambitious energy efficiency and sustainability goals with the project's highly specific interior program requirements.
A lot of what we do is to look at how the building is going to operate once it's built. So we'll do a lot of modeling to understand how much energy it's going to use, what kind of environment it's going to have inside of it. We use a software, IES Virtual Environment, for most of our modeling, which is a great, powerful tool that lets us look at not just energy, but we can look at the actual thermal comfort of a space. This project being a very glassy building, having archival elements to it, you know, people actively working on the types of things that Phillips described here that, you know, could be damaged by the sunlight, for example. Like, we need to model that to understand in reality, how is it going to affect that? How is the glass going to work? Do we need a different pattern on it to get rid of different wavelengths of ultraviolet light? And that was one big part of this project, was to study that, so that once the building was in operation and running, we weren't finding out after the fact that, you know, the sunlight was deteriorating elements of artifacts. And we did do the forward modeling of that in the software when the project was being designed. But after it was built, before the acceptance of the building, we went through with actual meters and validated the performance of the glass system that we modeled and found that it was actually outperforming what we predicted it was doing. So that was a real pleasant validation of the work that we did there. And then, of course, on the energy side, the building's got to be conditioned 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, how much energy does that take? What is it going to cost to operate the building? That was something, you know, we studied and modeled. And then how much are we now offsetting with the solar generation is another part that we were able to use our modeling to validate after the fact once things are in operation.
Set within a 17.5-acre site, the building occupies less than 4% of the land, preserving adjacent wetlands and foregrounding the relationship between architecture and landscape.
We had to work with a gently sloping site from east to west, and further down from the west on the western mid part of the site, there was a creek that went through that had some limited wetlands. Not really impacting us too much, although we had to control runoff. We had 17.5 acres. It was a soybean field. So the effort was to kind of reintroduce this idea of prairie back to the site, but in a more sophisticated way. As Tom Osland always says, is that the generator for the landscape was really this kind of defensive mechanism in the military, which was this rampart, which is this larger circle that you see going around the site. And not only that, you know, there's also other concentric circles of walkways. And then connecting this circle from one end to the other are these allays, two allays of oak trees. And then through those allays, there's commemorative benches and things of that nature. There are, obviously, we needed to have retention, but the retention ponds on either side, east and west, are actually used for irrigation. So that we're not, you know, we're very limited water is used for irrigation outside of what we can control in the retention ponds. And for those who know, you know, prairie plants are very sturdy. They had to be sturdy, right? And they still are sturdy. So, you know, they kind of live with the cycles. And within this circle was placed this building. And as you move around the building, there's parking east and west, and then there's a celebration plaza in the front with the seven flags. And I remember when Helmut and I made our first presentation to Colonel Pritzker, we had the American flag in the middle, and we had the armed forces on either side. The first thing she said to us was, the American flag is on the left. And then you have the Army, Marines, Navy, Air Force, and you're missing the Coast Guard and Merchant Marines. So we had a little bit of a military history lesson there. And so you see the flags there, and then there's a plaza. And what they do on this plaza is, like, during this Memorial Day, Veterans Day, any of these military holidays, they actually have a ceremony out there, and people from the neighborhood come, or people associated with the museum. And it just... it becomes part of what the entity is on that site.
A modular 36-foot grid organizes the building, with exposed steel trusses forming both the sidewalls and the primary support for the elevated roof.
There's not much in unique materials. It is steel and concrete and glass and a metal deck, an acoustic metal deck roof with a conventional roofing system. However, that being said, the whole idea was that this building was rough and tough like a piece of military equipment. All the bolts are exposed. We didn't grind down the welds to make it perfect. We wanted this to be just kind of a tough structure. And then this kind of pristine skin is more of the kind of the discipline, right, of the military. So the idea was that we had these two parallel trusses. They're about 360 feet long. They sit on seven pins, and they kind of slope just a little bit outward. And then infilling this is a fairly standard steel structure on a 36 by 36 foot grid. Because the building was one story, we could leave all the steel exposed, you know, so it's just a painted steel structure. The seven pins are kind of important because, you know, we wanted the loads to come down on the vertical cords of the trusses. However, Pepper Construction, the contractor, figured out that they could use these pins to fabricate these trusses, laying down, and then lift them up to form the building. And literally one day the structure was all down on the ground, the next day it was up. And it was kind of a, I went to this lifting of the trusses and it was very cool. They had three cranes with red and green lights and a guy with an iPad standing on the slab. And his job was to make sure that the lights were always green. And if one's lights turned red, they stopped because they couldn't have any torsion in any of these trusses. So it was kind of a choreographed like a dance. But the structure itself is really the architecture.
Well, I mean, the steel was pretty difficult. And I would say probably that connection between the steel and the glass. You know, that whole system was extremely complicated. We knew that going in.
This is Greg Leofanti, Senior Vice President and Project Executive at Pepper Construction, the contractor on the project.
And I guess personally, I thought we would encounter more problems. We were able, because we did it virtually on a computer screen, a BIM model, and we tweaked details electronically, we were able to fit glass panels that were required to be very precise. We were able to fit them with the structure quite well. We had some corner issues, you know, like that we kind of, those for sure we knew we were going to have a problem with. Every single corner of the building, those details were just not 100% figured out, and we had to really kind of figure them out in the field. But the most difficult part was the exterior, was just getting the glass to fit around the steel properly without some big problem.
A high-performance patterned glass facade echoes the rhythm of the structure, blending expression and efficiency. By expressing the steel framework through the facade, the building becomes a legible object, one in which form, function, and engineering are tightly aligned.
The criteria was that we needed to be at about 68 degrees Fahrenheit, plus or minus a degree. And the relative humidity needed to be at 45%. I think it was like plus two, minus one, if I recall correctly. 24/7, both levels of the building. So that was the design criteria that the engineers had to work with. And, you know, like I said before, it's the sophistication of the glass that makes this possible.
It's not just the glass, but also the shape of the building contributed to that. You the cantilevered roof and things like that added elements of shading that helped with, you know, the summer. That was one thing we looked at, was when the sun's setting. If you drive up, you haven't been to Wisconsin. If you drive up to Wisconsin, it's a big flat area, and you can see this coming from a mile away, and it's really striking how it comes out of the land. But it is exposed, and it's exposed to all of the wind, the rain, and especially the sun, not being shaded completely around the building. So the building itself creating its own shade helps with some of the load factors to reduce the amount of energy we'd have to offset. And then the design engineer did a great job, very creative design to distribute the air from underneath the floor. One, it keeps, I think, you know, ductwork and things out of the space itself, so it's aesthetically pleasing that way. But it also is a very effective way to wash the sides of the building to keep any kind of thermal energy coming into the building that might be affecting the archival artifacts and activities that are happening in the space. So we did model this from like a comfort perspective using our software and made sure that we were maintaining those conditions at all times with the types of design. We're able to see how the distribution would work in the space. We didn't do any, you know, computational fluid dynamics modeling or anything like that, but we did do modeling to the effect of making sure that the occupied areas, the spaces that were going to be affected, stayed within those ranges.
As Benny said, all the air distribution is at the perimeter, with the exception of this little core. Everything is at the perimeter. And then, you know, we always believe in these taller spaces that we should allow the air to stratify. You know, and you only need to really cool, you know, condition the first 2 meters of space. After that, who actually cares, right? You can just, but we just don't want 2-meter spaces throughout our world. So we have a series on each side of the east and west side. There are a series of operable vents. They do two things, say, for smoke evacuation, but they also, if there is too much excess heat, we can dispel it to the outside.
There's glass on all sides of this building, correct?
There is glass on the east and west side, which is heavily fritted. And the frit is there to, you know, represent this kind of structure and also for more energy reasons. On the north side, there is no frit. It is just the coated glass. On the south side, it is probably, I would say, 65% metal with a clear story above it, because that's where the loading docks are, and we have all the louvers for the mechanical systems and emergency generator, and on and on and on.
Below grade, nearly 15,000 square feet of archival storage is carefully integrated into the massing, preserving the thermal stability required for long-term collection care.
It is literally just a basement, okay? Now, there is some point where you can take advantage of the natural cooling of the earth, right? I don't think we're quite that deep, but, you know, it's a fairly deep basement. And, you know, it was just concrete walls. And, you know, we have ductwork that was running along the east and west side that was feeding up, but it was also feeding down. One of the biggest challenges was we originally had a dry sprinkler system in the basement, and that kind of went away for a number of reasons. And so there was an additional trench drainage system that was added along the entire length of the building, I think spaced equally across the width, so that if the sprinklers did go off, the water would not start collecting. It would just go directly off it. But other than that, there was, you know, other than just maintaining temperature and humidity, it's a large basement. There was one special room that was kind of like an ice box where they kept glass plates and films, and another room that was locked where they kept firearms. And then adjacent to it, immediately to the south, was the mechanical plant, which, I don't know, when I saw the photos, I've been in it as the cleanest mechanical plant I've ever seen in my life.
It very much is very clean. And one of the things my team commissioned the building before it opens, we tested the building systems to make sure everything works correctly, the mechanicals that Phil's talking about. And one of the requirements that the contractor had, the Pepper Construction asked us to take a look at, was to validate the asymmetric temperature differences. So the temperatures at basically every single 6-inch element up from the floor in the basement to the ceiling of the basement to see how uniform it was. And we don't want the stratification in the basement where the storage can be on shelving. You want fairly uniform. So that was one of the unique requirements of the project, was to go through and validate that we had this temperature grid that was even distributed throughout the space.
Modular systems inside the building allow spaces to adapt over time, supporting the museum's evolving collections and programming needs. Transparent partitions expose portions of the workspace, allowing visitors to understand the curatorial and archival processes typically hidden from public view.
We kept it simple. You walk into the building and you see this 36-foot structure. And what we did was we painted, it was all the columns and primary beams on a 36-foot grid are painted red, including the truss. All the intermediate beams are painted black, so that you've got this kind of order of structure as it goes through the building. About 72 feet in, there is a core. It's essentially a drywall box that extends up about 12 feet. And within it, there's a catering kitchen, there are toilet rooms, there are meeting rooms, there's a research room and other offices. And that is, gypsum board is painted gray, but there is a black expanded aluminum screen around it so that you get this other kind of ethereal feeling. When you see it, it has kind of soft edges, even though it's very hard. The floor is all just epoxy. It's kind of a deco flake epoxy, so, you know, there are no joints in it. It's beautiful. You go in and it's just expansive, one surface. As you get to the south side of the core, there are two glass walls and doors that are secure the public area from the work area. So they didn't want people. They wanted people to be able to see in, but they didn't want people to go through there. And then behind there is where people, the staff, process new material that's coming in or getting ready for material that is going to be sent off to an exhibition somewhere or borrowed by somebody, by another institution. At the south end, then, is also, there's a loading dock, various electrical rooms, and an elevator down to the base, to the basement, and a scanning room, a 3D scanning room, where they take every piece that comes in and they scan it. So they have a digital record and then the physical piece. And a book restoration room, which is in one corner, and it still takes advantage of the glass. And that's allowed to, so that if books that come in that are precious and damaged, they can be restored. Then opposite that, on the other end, is a workshop where they build crates to move things around. It's a very simple and logical progression of spaces.
Is this open, like, to the public, that kind of museum?
No, it's open to the public. It is open to to people doing research, military research. And it's kind of, you know, it's an interesting place to go. I remember at the grand opening, they had there was this cartoonist who drew caricatures, Bill Maudlin. He drew these all while he was in the trenches. And they had all this displayed, and that you could go and read these things. It's absolutely fascinating. They have, you know, the old World War II and World War I posters that you used to, that you've all seen. They have some of the original artwork for this. It's the original watercolor. It's really fascinating stuff. So it's open, I think, 4 days a week, and the public can go there and see the space, enjoy the grounds can be enjoyed anytime. You know, researchers, I believe they just make an appointment to get there.
Humidity, temperature, and overall air quality control were essential considerations, carefully balanced with the project's energy efficiency goals and the desire to maintain the clarity of the glass facade.
The unique consideration would be, I think, that the temperature and humidity demands, because that, in the end, drives everything. And you just don't have these in buildings. I mean, in Germany, the buildings we did in Germany, because of the way the German laws are written, you know, you have to have a certain humidity level in an office or apartment building that you would not have to deal with in the United States. But archival storage is kind of an animal amongst itself, you know, and so it has certain things. And ours is, because ours is almost kind of an average, because, you know, if you have uniforms, you'd have a different, or fabric, you'd have a different criteria than if you had paper or that you had metal. So we had to kind of take that and, you know, average it out so that, you know, we could kind of catch everything.
Add to the temperature and humidity requirements that the first floor is very glass oriented and lots of daylight, which, think about, what museum have you ever been to that is a lot of glass? Usually there's no glass. Everything's kind of hidden behind dark walls and in spaces. In this case, that's not the case at all. And so having that element is very unique, because now, again, we need to control the ultraviolet sun waves that come into the space in addition to the temperature and humidity constraints. And it was a challenge to look at.
We tried to anticipate a lot. But sometimes we look like eyes wide open and almost too pessimistic. We try to come up with all the scenarios of all the problems that we will encounter, because we typically do on a construction project. Something like this, was the nice part was that it was in an open field. This is kind of the opposite way. We anticipated finding water underneath the building and mitigating water, groundwater, and we actually didn't find as much water as we thought we would. So that was kind of the cross, like the other way, like we were anticipating a big problem when we dug the building, and it was not as big of a problem as we anticipated. So, you know, water is a big problem in a basement with precious artifacts. You can't have water in there. So that was a big component to building that. The basement was making sure that it was watertight, waterproof underneath. And we just thought we would have a lot of groundwater that we would have to move away via pumps or well points, and we didn't have to do that. So it was actually that was a positive thing. You know, it helped us get the waterproofing membrane in underneath the foundation and build a watertight building.
Part of the sustainability initiative required building an energy model from the beginning to precisely design the envelope performance.
I don't like to use the word sustainability. I mean, sustainability is permission to play these days. I like to say that we work on buildings that perform at a higher level. And if you look back at the work we've done, you'll see that performance has always been kind of a generator of design and engineering. And we look at it as a synthesis. So this is nothing that was actually new to us. It's something that we started right from the beginning. Even the mechanical engineer, the MEP engineers we hired, we wanted to make sure that they had a rich resume of archival storage, because we don't need to reinvent the wheel on a lot of these things. And we always, you know, Helmut believed this, and I'd been with him for a very long time, that glass seems to be this one material that keeps on improving. You know, the sophistication of the coatings, and in this case, the addition of Frit, which has been around for a while, all work together to improve the performance of the envelope.
Very much was integral to the whole project from the beginning, that the Yon team really had so many ideas and so many iterations of this project that we weren't just doing one model of one idea. We were comparing dozens and dozens of iterations of different glass combinations, different Frit patterns, different orientations of things on the building. So it was really, you know, a study to kind of find out what worked best throughout the project. It was I echo what Phil said here. You know, it's high performance buildings are what we're trying to do, and you know, this team really knew how to push that envelope.
Numerous iterations of the on-site solar field were explored throughout the design process, an essential system that powers the entire campus and underscores the project's environmental ambition.
For me and our team, one of the most difficult things to work out was going through different iterations of the solar designs, the solar panel designs. So we, again, used this IES virtual environment modeling software, which let us do lots and lots and lots of iterations of things. But what no software could do was understand some of the concepts that we were studying. And one of the earlier concepts, the roof of the main archival building at the time was glass. And the Frit pattern was made actually out of solar collectors that were built into this custom glass. It was an amorphous silicone material that the Yon office had kind of designed into a unique pattern. And that isn't something that you buy off the shelf. And we had to figure out how to model that, and study that, and determine how much energy it could produce, in addition to looking at a combination of that with typical solar panels as well. The challenge for us was just all the iterations we had.
The challenge on this one was to really get everything right. Yes, we had to solve the structure with our structural engineers and the mechanical system and made sure everything, you know, worked from an energy standpoint. You know, we did have, as Benny said, we did have a glass roof, and for cost reasons, that was changed to a solid roof, which I think made the building better. But I think what we really worked on was the pattern of this Frit. And worked on what the density of it. The red is much more dense than the black. It is slightly offset because we didn't want a joint, a glass joint in the middle of the red vertical. So you get the kind of pleasant result is you get this kind of interesting layering of, you know, the structure and the glass, and then you still have this kind of view to the outside. So, you know, that may have been the more challenging aspect of it.
Through meticulous design modeling and careful planning, the construction process encountered little to no hurdles, in large part due to full-scale mock-ups.
When I would come up there to go to the owner-architect contractors meetings, I'd always stop at the superintendent's trailer. And, you know, we'd have some cookies and coffee, and he was an older Italian guy, and he'd talk about his tomatoes, and we'd talk about our families. And he'd say, Phil, let's go out on the site. I want to show you some things. And we solved those problems right there. And that was, you know, that was kind of the beauty of how this whole thing worked.
I agree with Phil. This is rarely does this happen where we have a project go so smoothly. And from our team that was commissioning and testing the building systems, there's always a war story on a project about something that went wrong or didn't work out. And we don't have any good stories from this one. The contractor Pepper Construction did a great job of coordination. The trades that worked on the systems were all responsive, and everybody had maybe a sense of pride working on the project and spent that extra time doing it. You know, the challenges we had during construction were just validating the things that we'd modeled during design. And we were really happy to go through that and never found a real problem.
You know, the other thing we did was, and this was probably the last thing Helmut saw before he passed, was we had a full-scale mock-up of maybe like 15 feet in height of the glass and the steel, so that we could make sure it was right before we did, you know, before we embarked on this big adventure. The other thing we did was GSI, who was the facade contractor, we had various big glass samples at Pepper's, one of their offices in Barrington, Illinois, where we had the big glass panels where we could actually make sure that the color was right before we got to the other mock-up. So, you know, mock-ups are really important, and that's how these projects like this become very successful.
We did some renderings in-house. We did a lot of renderings on a computer model of the project with all the landscaping and the colors of the building. We tried to get everything as accurate as we could in a computer model. And it's just so strikingly, for me, it's just incredible to see the end product look so much like that computer model. It's just so realistic. And that we built it with all the landscaping in lines and all the layout and all the engineering that went into the site work, that it just looks so similar to the way it was intended, you know, and like sometimes you can't tell the difference. So for me, I love the combination of the building and the landscaping and all the colors and the way it all came together in my mind as the vision of Helmut Jahn's vision came to life. Because I mean, all the renderings from the beginning first day look exactly like it did when we finished the job. So that's what stands out to me. I just love that. It still surprises me when I look at the renderings and the building. I have to kind of take a double, honestly, I take a double take. You know, it's like, is that the building for real or is it the rendering? Because we tricked ourselves.
The strong collaboration between all stakeholders not only surmounted the project's challenges, but also provided meaningful insights for Phil and Ben.
I think the biggest lesson learned here was just how well a team can work when everybody is on the same page about things. In the design phase of this, we would meet at Jan's office very, very regularly to go through the design concepts. This was a challenging project for us because things were constantly changing. We enjoy that and appreciate it. That's what makes it fun. It's not just a one-time thing that we're working on. It's constantly evolving. And I think just going through that process and the collaboration that we had with the design team, it was really something that I hadn't experienced in this kind of fashion before that worked this well.
You know, we had a team that worked well together, and you don't always get that. You'd like to think that every job is going to be great, but every job is not great. And, you know, this one, we had great collaboration between all the design professionals that were involved in this project, from structure to energy to MEP systems, landscape architect, lighting. It was really a joy. And then when you layered in a contractor who really understood the structure and how this whole thing needed to go together. That helped. But, you know, it never works unless you actually have a client that believes in the same mission. And this client was you know, really stellar in helping us and supporting what we wanted to do as a design professional.
As both a cultural landmark and a working archive, the Pritzker Military Archive and Library connects visitors to the ongoing preservation of military history while offering a transparent, forward-looking framework for the collection's future. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what Phil and Ben thought we could be doing better as an industry when it comes to bridging that gap between design, construction, and operations.
I think as an industry, having worked in a traditional MEP environment, an architectural environment for many years, what I saw lacking was more feedback from the people in the buildings after you've made them and created them. And how they operate, how they run, how efficient they are, all these factors come into play. How accessible they are, how easy they are to maintain. These are things that, you know, we don't always bring backwards into our designs. We're always thinking forward about the next great design, but we can inform a lot from not just near-term history, but long-term history of older buildings and things before there was air conditioning and conventional heating systems in buildings. There's a lot of lessons we can learn from the past that I think bring into our designs and concepts now to make them more passive, more have more longevity to them, and be more accessible to everybody.
Well, this may sound a little mundane and maybe a little bit conceited, but I think many more problems could be solved in the field if an architect made a sketch in front of the contractor and handed it to him and said, this is how it needs to be done. And we forget about all the paperwork that's involved, or I have to go back and do it on the Revit model. You know, so many things can be handled in a much more simple manner. You know, I see that's missing. And when we interview young architects, I want to make sure they can make a sketch.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Phil and Ben. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
The reason I even started my company almost 14 years ago was to have positive impact in everything we touch. And our vision is to make the world more efficient. And that can be in a lot of different ways. It doesn't have to just be energy efficiency, but we're trying to make high performance buildings. And so me personally or my firm having one shining star of an impact. It's the combination of all the stars that we put together. Every single project we have has a positive impact. It's a better performing building than it would have been if we hadn't worked on it. And so I'm always really proud to look at the skyline of Chicago and the other cities we worked in and say, you know, we worked on that building. We helped it be better than what it could have been.
Well, I think we'll just remember that this buildings fit into their context. You know, they are enjoyable places to live, work, play, experience. And I think that's kind of the one singular goal that I want to see happen with every building I work on.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.